Ultra Running Magazine.
Ultra Running Magazine, it's the Bible. We've talked about the Bible. Really cool things. One of the things that we've recently done is they've created a race calendar that's that we've linked to our website. So if you go to trailrunnernation.com, on the very top banner up there, there's a thing that says race calendar, and you can click on that, and you can see all of the upcoming races, and you can search for.
So essentially, Ultra Running Magazine has created this awesome race calendar.
That we've plagiarized.
We've linked it, and we're taking credit for it.
No, there are names on it.
Oh, good.
We have a lot of really cool things on our website, including our store and our partners page. Make sure you click on those and see if there's anything that tickles your fancy.
So go get Ultra Running Magazine. Be a subscriber like Scott and I are. It's a great, great resource. Tailwind Nutrition. This episode brought to you by Tailwind.
Scott? And we have Travis Macy, our coach, on for another Ask the Coach question for Tailwind Nutrition. And here's the thought that we had a podcast a while ago where Dina Griffin came on with Travis, and we talked about the testing that Travis did with metabolic efficiency. And I went and took the test today, and there was something that was glaring. I didn't get to see the results, but one thing was very evident. Is I was working harder walking at a 4 minute, 4 mile per hour rate than when I increased the speed to 5 mile per hour and started running. And I thought that was really interesting and had a discussion. So the question for you, Coach Macy, is how can we learn how to walk more efficiently?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think very relevant to ultra running because, you know, if you look at, well, these long races, probably you're spending a lot of time walking, and that's true. You know, the people who are trying to win, they're doing a lot of walking and power hiking, especially uphills, and then sometimes, you know, your walking's part of your strategy, or sometimes you're reduced to walking. So, it's an important thing to do, and I mean, the simple answer is the body adapts to what you ask it to do. So if you want to be better at walking, then walking is actually, you know, probably the thing to do. And that could, you know, for me, I integrate a lot of walking in the form of, you know, really actually high effort power hiking on a lot of my runs. Cause I'm doing all my training at altitude. It's all up and down hills. And, you know, a lot of these steep hills, you know, unless I want to be really smashing myself, I'm going to be walking up it anyway.
So, Travis, let me ask you, do you have some key strategies or things that you keep in mind when you're at the base of a hill, you know, you need to go to the top, you know, you're going to be power hiking. What do you do to remain efficient and on purpose during that whole hike?
Yeah, that's a great question, you know, and I did a few Facebook Live videos on that recently because it's a question I do get a lot, but, you know, there's different things that you can do. Using poles might be one thing. Some mm-hmm. people like that, some don't. I'm a big fan of poles for certain races. And then also there's different ways to walk as well. You know, you might swing your arms back and forth, kind of like you're running. You might put your hands kind of on your knees or your upper thighs, you know, especially on a real steep hill, and then you're getting some push with those as well. And then you might try different cadences. You know, you could do a very short, quick stride, or you can do, you know, long strides where you're covering quite a bit of ground and then really pushing off and using a lot of effort on each push. So those are all different things you can try. You know, most of those are relevant to uphill, and they could be, you know, different things on different grades, but those are all things that I practice very intentionally so that I know, you know, what feels good to me over time. You know, if all you do is just running, your body's probably not going to be ready for a lot of walking.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I learned when I was trying to learn the body mechanics is that so much of the power for movement and gait comes from the arms and the torso, twisting and rotating back and forth with the hip one way and then the shoulder the opposite direction. And that is the arm swing that you're talking about. If we put some effort and some thought into the movement of this arm, the rest will follow too. So we shouldn't ignore what's happening above the waist and just kind of focus on below only, but really turn the focus up top and create a cadence and a rhythm with the upper body as well. And the legs will have to follow.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's, you know, something you want to practice. The other method I was talking about, you know, kind of the hands on the knees, mm-hmm. That one really does a number on your back, you know, as far as your lower back goes. That's almost like a cycling position. And if you try to do that without practicing, probably your back's going to get pretty sore pretty quick. So if you have a steep race coming up and you think that's something you might want to utilize, well, you better do it. And that's, you know, that position, you can really be going hard, you know, full out aerobic effort, but you're not running, you're hiking.
Yeah. And I was talking about keeping the cadence on going up hills, but focusing, again, I've been doing this lately, just running on the flats, thinking about the arm movement too, and creating some cadence with the arms moving back and forth is a nice way to switch the focus and accomplish the same thing, which is running efficiency.
Yeah, absolutely. I think back to like high school running, I'd be doing my 2 mile, you know, and I'd start to, you know, fall apart and my form's going downhill and my beloved coach, use your arms, you know, get upright. And I mean, he was right. Like, what a simple, easy fix.
Yeah.
One of the things that I learned early on in this running ultras stuff is it's good to practice your walking gait anyway, so that you know what speed you can walk. So that when you get to a race, you know that, you know, I can get out there when I'm tired and I can walk at 4 mile per hour pace or 15 minute mile pace. And maybe that's a good strategy to take during the race. So if you know what your walking pace is, I think that's very valuable.
It's important to walk with a purpose, because I've been out there and I think, okay, I'll walk this section. And then the next thing you know, I'm kind of just meandering through, like I'm sashaying. And I need to walk with purpose and make sure that I'm always going and still trying to cover ground with that. So walking is a strategy as long as it is purposeful.
Yeah.
I think you guys are both right on about that. And, you know, really, you know, if you know your pace or you know what you can do, you know, whether it's flat or going uphill or even down, then you can make the decision. Well, right now I could walk as fast as I'm running and it's probably going to be more efficient.
You know,
having done that practice. I think it's a very relevant thing to work on.
What else do you have going on, Travis? Anything new while we've got you on the line here?
Well, we're in Moab for spring break. Sorry about these engines in the background. There's some Jeeps and stuff here. And kind of my big professional push recently, in addition to my, you know, kind of normal one-on-one coaching, is I created a course. It's called the Ultra Mindset Academy e-course. And basically, I kind of take the concepts of my book, The Ultra Mindset, and put it into an eight-week package. So it's something that people do on their own schedule. It's about 20 minutes a day for 8 weeks, and it's been a lot of fun. I connect with people weekly in a video call, and I'd love to offer. I always like getting on with you guys. So anyone who hears this from the TRN podcast, I'd like to offer $150 off the tuition. And if anyone's interested, you can just reach out to me through my website or Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and I'll tell you how to get going.
That sounds fantastic. And I know we've done a podcast in the past on Ultra Mindset with Travis Macy regarding his book, Ultra Mindset. You can go back and listen to that podcast and get some good principles. So I'd encourage people to do that. Scott, you can link that podcast to these show notes, right?
It's amazing what I can do, Don.
Yeah, that's good. I love putting you tasks for you to do when it doesn't involve me. That sounds good. Travis, thanks so much for letting us discuss with you the efficiencies of running versus walking versus hiking and all that is involved with those concepts.
Sounds good, guys. Look forward to doing it again. I always love listening. I tell you, like, half the people I meet out on the trails, man, have you heard Trail Runner Nation? And, you know, it's great. You guys are doing a good job, so I'm glad to be part of it.
Well, you are part of it, absolutely. We appreciate it. So go out and enjoy that Moab desert.
So go to our partners page
and click on the Tailwind Nutrition link.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's
I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. Am I starting?
Yeah, you start.
Okay. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And I am Scott Warr, and today we're joined by Emily Peterson. She is an ultra runner based out of Marin County. Is that correct, Emily?
Yes, that's correct.
And she's not just a trail runner. She's pretty fast. Yeah. In fact, I did a little research.
Good.
Not a lot, just a little bit.
As you should.
Just a little bit. She's the defending champion, the two-year champion of the Marin Ultra Challenge 50K.
Ooh, that's a beautiful race.
So she's won that 2 years in a row. She's also, this is top honor. She has placed in the top 10 at all of the ultras she has competed in when she started back in 2013. Is that accurate?
I think that's correct. You've done your ultra sign-up homework.
Well, hey, don't tell people my trick.
Emily, we've done more than that, because when we confirmed this podcast, I don't know if you noticed, but there's been a drone overhead. We've been following, doing deep research. We know exactly your habits, and you've qualified as guest here on TRN.
The reason why we bring that up is because we're going to talk about a subject that we think that trail runners should be very aware of, and hopefully are motivated to get engaged with, and that is this whole idea with public lands. Now, to set the stage, in the United States, and I don't know anything outside the United States, but in the United States, the federal government years and years ago set aside public lands. There are 640, and correct me if I'm wrong, 640 million acres of public lands that the federal government owns, or let me rephrase that we as citizens of the United States own. Is that correct, mm-hmm. Emily?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so Don, I'm going to ask you just a simple question.
Okay.
How big is an acre?
Oh, it's...
When I say 640 million acres, what kind of size are you picturing in your head?
In my mind, I would think that that's about 25% of the United States.
That could be correct. I don't know. But this is what I did. Just to get us our minds wrapped around the size of the acreage that you and I and all of us trail, anybody that's just U.S. citizen own, if you were to take the top three biggest states, California, well, actually, let's go in order, Alaska, Texas, and California, all of the three biggest states, that's around just over 700 million acres.
Wow. Good research.
So almost the same size as the top three states in the United States are public lands. Hmm.
So that's our topic today, and our expert here, Emily Peterson. Tell us a little bit about you getting...
Well, we need to qualify Emily again. She's not only a trail runner, but she's also a professional. She's an environmental philanthropist, which I'm not sure exactly what that means. Can you tell us what that means?
Sure. So just to clarify, I would say I'm not a philanthropist myself. I actually work in environmental consulting in the philanthropic field. So we basically help advise environmental grant makers on their strategies.
Hmm. Okay. So what's going on right now with public lands, and why is this a big deal? Why shouldn't we just be skipping down the road saying, I own 640,000 acres, million acres?
Sure. Yeah. So I think it's been quietly bubbling up. And so, you know, I think it's to no one's discredit that it's not immediately on their radar, because I think it's been somewhat of a quiet issue kind of happening in, you know, congressional halls and in state offices. But now it's really coming to the fore. And that's why we're eager to get trail runners involved on this issue. But yeah, essentially, there is kind of pressure at both the state and federal level to look into transferring public lands, which, you know, as you correctly pointed out, these are lands that as Americans, we all own a slice of. And that's something that we're really trying to emphasize with our initiative Run Wild, is that this isn't, you know, something that is for one sector or that one part of the government owns. It's like, as an American, you have a share in this. And so even if you live on an opposite side of the country, that's kind of a unique part of your heritage that you own and, you know, should have a say in what's happening. And essentially, there's a quiet movement that, again, is starting to really get momentum. And we've been working with the Wilderness Society, which we can go into the details of that, but they've actually started a campaign last summer to tee up for this challenge. And the idea is the public lands would be transferred from the federal level to potentially the state level. And then at that point, what happens is it opens them up either for development, which could be for extraction, for other industries, to real estate. So essentially, it takes our public lands out of public hands, meaning that we would lose access to them in perpetuity. And so the idea with Run Wild is we are trying to bring this kind of movement to the foreground, to celebrate the lands that we currently have under protection, but to also kind of draw attention to the fact that this is real and it's happening, and we would just like for people to have a say in the lands that are at risk.
So, Emily, the big question for me, and I'm not big on politics, but for me, I am a proponent of giving states more power versus the federal government more power. And I see some of the local trails here or local land, public lands here in California that are owned and run by the state, and it seems like they do a pretty good job. And in other areas, the states actually do a better job of managing programs and resources than the federal government. Why is this a bad thing that this public land is being transferred to the states? My knee-jerk would be, hey, the states are going to do a better job because it's closer to their vest. It's in their property, right?
Sure, it's a great point. And I think for a lot of us who are into kind of living local and supporting, you know, local businesses, that argument can ring true. I think really it comes down to an issue of economics. So federal government is obviously a lot larger. They own about half of the land in the West. And so Western land policy is just kind of a different beast than areas in the rest of the country, the way that land is managed and financed. And so essentially what would happen if the federal government basically transfers large tracts of land to the state level? Most states are in a position that they are not able to financially manage that at a level that we would hope. And so it would mean that they would essentially sell it off to the highest bidder in many cases. And what that would look like is probably opening it up to development, which could be mining, logging, oil and gas. And so essentially, the issue is that generally once these lands are transferred to states, they are then sold off to whoever puts in the highest bid.
So that's my question, Emily. How do we know that the states are actually going to sell them off? I mean, they're not selling off, maybe, I don't know. Are they selling off the lands they currently have? And we're going to see this transfer as an automatic for sale sign on them when they come over to the state side?
Or is there precedent? Is there history of them doing that, right?
Yes. No, I think it's more acting on precedent and understanding kind of the current rationale of a lot of lawmakers who are pushing for this. They tend to be aligned with extractive industries. They are not necessarily, you know, exactly with the outdoor industry. And so I think they would look at the financial figure and look at the potential of an oil and gas lease and see the potential for tax revenue there, and likely prioritize that over a trail that, you know, hikers and mountain bikers and runners could enjoy. So I think we're not trying to be alarmists, but we are acting on precedent based on what, you know, past lawmakers have done, and then based on, you know, the current interests of lawmakers who are pushing for this issue.
Tell us, and I don't know if this falls into that category of precedent, but here in the United States, there's a big trade show that happens twice a year. It's called the Outdoor Retailer Show, and it happens in Salt Lake City, Utah. And something happened. Can you fill us in on the details of what something that the state did that got a lot of these outdoor companies so outrage that big name companies have pulled out and said, we are not coming to the Outdoor Retailer Show. This is a big, big show, brings a lot of money into Utah. Can you can you kind of explain that and how that applies to this?
Sure. It's a great example. Thanks for bringing it up. Quite relevant to this issue. And I think it's a wonderful case where the outdoor industry, like regardless of brand and sport, has really aligned on this issue in a very clear way. So essentially, there's an area called the Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, and that was made a national monument by President Obama just before he left office. And the Utah government governor has proposed rescinding that monument. And in early February, I believe, Yvon Chouinard of Patagonia wrote an open letter basically suggesting, you know, if the Utah government was hostile to public lands, that was basically a direct attack on the outdoor industry. The idea being that the Utah economy receives, you know, a lot of benefits, both in jobs. In fact, I have a few figures here from a report that was carried out. So according to the Outdoor Industry Association, the Utah government receives $12 billion in direct consumer spending annually, and the outdoor industry supports 122,000 jobs in the state. And so Patagonia really kind of got this momentum started with the, you know, the industry. And their letter basically said, you know, Bears Ears is one specific case, but we also recognize other basically, you know, anti-public land policies that are bubbling up in Utah, and it's a direct threat on our industry and our bottom line. And just kind of the notion of outdoor recreationists being able to enjoy the public lands throughout Utah. And so, you know, after Patagonia came out, several other retailers signed on. As I understand, a few weeks later, an open call was held between a few of these retailers and the Utah governor, and they essentially laid out their concerns. I think it was very, you know, cordial and clear-eyed, and they said, you know, here are four issues. We would like you to back off your pressure to rescind the Bears Ears National Monument. We would like XYZ. I think there were about four requests in terms of trying to create a more public land friendly environment in Utah and to basically express the concerns of the industry. It was not alarmist, but it was basically, hey, we contribute a lot to your state's economy, and it's not a great place to do business right now in terms of some of the policies that are coming up that we feel threaten to our livelihood. And as I understand, the Utah governor essentially said, if this is your ultimatum, you know, I'm backing off. Go ahead, leave the state if you'd like, but I'm standing by my word. And so, as I understand, the Outdoor Retailer Show, which brought quite a lot of money, you know, to the Utah economy annually, is, you know, not returning to Utah, maybe considering other places such as Boulder now.
So I guess my question, why is this happening? What is the motivation for the states to lobby, or the federal government to lobby, this change of ownership? I mean, I can't believe it's a financial thing. I can't believe the states are thinking, we want this land grab. We want to take ownership of this land so that we can turn it over to big industry, these extractors, and make more money than, I mean, it's not a revenue thing, is it? Why is this happening?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that it is essentially politics and money. I think it's kind of a strong anti-conservation move. And this is a great case in point where kind of the valuation of natural resources can come into play. And so the Outdoor Industry Association, which I just shared a few really great statements from them in terms of direct contributions to the Utah economy, they have been trying to, you know, push the federal government to basically provide a financial figure to the outdoor industry. And the idea being that if you have a federal agency like the Bureau of Land Management, which manages quite a lot of land in the U.S., and they're presented with different ways to manage attractive land, whether it's in Utah, Montana, or Colorado, and, you know, they're looking at a spreadsheet and they're considering different uses, and there's oil and gas that could take place, there's mining, You know, trail running doesn't really have a place on that. And so being able to really quantify, okay, here is the direct spending that could take place. Here are the jobs that could be generated. And here's the tax revenue that could be provided to the state government is very valuable. And so I think traditionally that's not accounted for in a very fine sense. I know that there's increasing pressure to do that. And that's why it's really great for, you know, industries such as the trail running community, other affinity groups to come together and say, collectively, like the trail running community might feel small as compared to oil and gas, but, you know, ironically, I've heard that they contribute, you know, the outdoor industry can basically dwarf the extractive industries in Utah by 3 times in terms wow. of revenue. And that was a quote I heard just this week from a Patagonia source. But I think there's, you know, the more that we can really bring this to light, that my sense is it is usually the immediate bottom line. You know, governments see that they can quickly sell off an oil and gas lease, but, you know, in my mind, that is a short-term gain. Whereas if you protect, you know, land in perpetuity, that will have long-lasting sustainable benefits and multiple users will have access to that. Whereas, you know, turning around an oil and gas lease is a matter of a few years, maybe a few decades, but, you know, in the lifespan of a forest or a mountain, that is just a blip in the map.
I want to get into Run Wild and some of the prominent names in the trail running community that have wrapped their arms around this as well. But before I do, perhaps I can ask a couple of questions. Just listening to the conversation, and perhaps you have the answer. What's the advantage to the federal government? Are they saying, we're tired of managing this, it's costing us money to manage, let's just shove it off to the state?
Why hasn't the federal government turned it over to these extractors to make money on it?
Sure, those are all great questions as well. So
answer Don's first. He actually had a question. I had another question, and I just totally ignored
so
his question.
First question is, what's the motivation of the federal government to now give the responsibility to the state so they can decrease their cost to manage the land? Is that what they're thinking?
Sure. So I'm not a personal land management expert, so I'll do my best. But my impression is that, yes, essentially it would come down to finances, that it takes pressure off the federal government. Again, I think it goes back to just the way that land is managed in the U.S. And, I believe the figure is that the federal government owns about half of U.S. Western lands. But it's also just comes down to politics, that if there's pressure and there is a way for both representatives and senators to transfer lands to the state level, that there is a, you know, policy opening for that to occur. So, you know, the federal, it's just kind of the way that Congress is set up, that the federal government as a whole, we kind of refer to that as this sort of the overriding authority. But, you know, really, if the states have a say through their representation in the House and the Senate, then it happens. So I'm not sure if that addresses your question. And then do you want to follow up with the second one?
No, Scott doesn't get to go yet.
I interrupted. I get slapped. I get put in the corner for a little bit.
Well, so now this big block of land has been moved from the Bureau of Land Management over to a state. And mm-hmm. now there is an oil and gas extraction contract that happens mm-hmm. at that level. Who's the beneficiary? Does it go to the state? Do they collect the money for this great contract, or is the federal government still associated? Who is going to have the windfall of this contract?
It's a great question. And again, it might be slightly beyond my level of expertise, but I believe that there would be revenues on both sides. I think there would be state and local revenues and then possibly federal revenues. And I'm not sure if the federal transaction takes place at kind of the point of the transfer or with the loyalties from the actual mining that would take place or the leases sell off.
Got it. And I would think mm-hmm. that the gas community has quite a bit of power in
lobby.
The lobbyists to try to help push mm-hmm. some of these things through. And that's part of the awareness program that I imagine that we're trying to create here or you have created. Scott, your question, sir.
Yeah, so my question is why has the federal government not jumped on this money-making opportunity and said, well, let's turn this around and give it to the extraction companies. Let's make all the money from it. Why should they transfer? And I think...
That's a good question.
I actually think I have an answer to this, but I want to hear your answer and then clarify what I understand.
Well, you can go first.
Yeah. Well, this is what I understand.
Yeah.
The federal government, there are laws that govern public lands. There's only... The public lands were created and they're protected by law. Once that shifts to the state government, there are no laws on the state level in some states that protect that. So I think that the reason the federal government can't make money is because they're governed by law that these lands have to be protected. And there's a certain protocol that they have to follow. Once it's transferred, the states...
Sometimes get to do what they want.
Is that correct?
Exactly. I think you've nailed it. So I myself am not a lawyer, so I don't want to overstate my expertise. But, you know, my understanding is that essentially we do have federal level laws that govern how these lands are managed and protected. And, you know, the state, as you said, simply does not have that. There is one case in particular, you know, that I think is pretty fascinating, which is the Endangered Species Act. So that's obviously federal level law. And if these lands are transferred to the state, those protections just aren't applicable and are not enforced. And so, you know, that has a lot of biodiversity implications and would be a case where, you know, there's a real disconnect between the federal and state level authorities and laws in place. Another example would be the Antiquities Act, which I believe helped with the designation of Bears Ears National Monument, as we discussed earlier in Utah. And again, that's a case where it was a federal level law that helped pass the designation of Bears Ears. And again, the state does not have that law. And so essentially, if that designation is rescinded at the federal level, then that opens up this amazing site, which if listeners haven't yet seen the Patagonia video documenting Bears Ears is phenomenal. They highlight it from the native tribes and the archaeological history that takes place there, the phenomenal climbing, the trail running with Luke Nelson, who's been a really great advocate on this issue. So yes, exactly. I think as you've mentioned, we have federal level laws that are governing how these lands are protected. Once it then drops down and gets basically passed to the states, those laws are not in effect or enforced.
Wow, that's incredible. Let me ask you this. Of those 640 million acres, does that include both federal and state, or is that just federal? Do you know that?
That's a great question. I believe it's just federal, but it's probably something we should, you know, consult an external source on.
We just know it's really big, and that's probably good enough.
I think that's a number that's thrown out, and I think it's big and impressive. And the underlying point there is that all Americans own this. And the idea being that if these lands are taken away, essentially it's a perpetuity thing, we will lose access forever. And so that's what we're just trying to emphasize with, you know, our initiative Run Wild and three groups like the Wilderness Society, is that this is an issue that all Americans should have a say in, and it should not be something that, you know, takes place quietly behind, you know, in congressional halls. It should be something that is out in the public, and that the public has a voice in what occurs with these lands.
Well, I think that sets the stage perfectly for Run Wild. Tell us about the genesis and who's involved and what's next.
Sure, great. So we started getting together in late January. There was a group of about 10 core friends. We're all Marin Trail runners. Most of us are friends through San Francisco Running Company, which, as you know, is just such a great community and hub for trail running, really in the country, and especially in Marin. It's just been such a great connector. So there's a handful of us involved, everyone from Dylan Bowman, Io Wang, Hallie Fox, a handful. So we're all essentially close friends and, you know, passionate trail runners. And at this time, the bill in Utah, H.R. 621, which was sponsored by Representative Jason Chaffetz, was under consideration, and essentially that would have turned over about 3.3 million acres of federal lands to the states. And that's where we really learned about this issue, and a lot of us were looking to become more civically engaged, and we kind of, you know, we sat down around my kitchen table and said, where do we plug in? And I think there was a lot happening in the country at the time and people feeling somewhat powerless. And we said, you know, our big rock is a trail running community. It's something that connects us all, that makes us grounded on a personal level, that gives us adventure, but that we can really leverage. And we decided to focus on the public lands issue because it seemed really salient. You know, it's really getting momentum politically. And we thought if we can just leverage the trail community in the sense that we cannot practice our sport without public lands. The week that we launched, we received a great note from a supporter in Idaho, and he said, you know, it just boggles my mind because a lot of other affinity groups, from hunters in particular, are so active on public land protection, and they've been absent from this debate in my backyard. And he said, you know, I don't think trail runners know that we need more than shoes to practice our sport. We need the land. And a simple closure of a gate will close off our sport. And it might sound somewhat dramatic, but I think especially in a place like Utah, that is a very real fact. And if you look at just about, you know, every major trail race, every kind of iconic trail race takes place on public lands. So, you know, this is an area that we thought it's coming. It was kind of this momentum and riding the tide where it was really coming into play politically. And we said, you know, let's plug in our connections with the trail running community and see, just put it out there and see what the reception is. And to be honest, we only turned 3 weeks yesterday, but the response has been phenomenal. We can hardly keep up with it, which is really exciting. And people from all around the country have contacted us saying, you know, thank you for forming. I've kind of intuitively understood this connection, but I didn't know that the public lands issue was really a huge concern. I figured the lands would always be there. They would not be taken away. It was never something on my mind. And they also comment that, you know, I have friends who are fishers, who are hunters, and they are so active on issues to protect the natural resources that make their sport possible. And, you know, my trail running friends haven't really engaged on this issue. And now I kind of feel like there's a platform to do so. So essentially that's, you know, what our purpose is with Run Wild. It's really to celebrate the lands that we enjoy and that are currently, you know, under strong protection, and then to really advocate for those lands that are at risk. And so that's why we plugged in with the Wilderness Society as a partner. They've been working on this issue protecting public lands for decades, and have been a real national leader on that, you know, in the U.S. conservation movement, and specifically on this issue of public lands takeovers. They actually started a campaign last summer to tee up for this issue. So they have lawyers on staff, they have, you know, scientists who are studying the lands that are most ecologically valuable, and they have advocates who really are monitoring the issue and have a good kind of pulse in what's happening. So that's a basic premise of what Run Wild is, and essentially it's just to give the trail community a voice in this issue.
So on the very tip of the iceberg, what we've done in this podcast is bring this issue to people's attention. And we're going to have some links in the podcast description that where people can go and learn more. But how can we get involved? I know, you know, just as a trail runner, well, part of our community is to go out and volunteer. Many races require volunteer hours. You know, we live at the foothills of Western states, and there's a great group of people that go out and do trail work every year and just put in hours and hours of maintaining these trails for recreation. How can we get involved and let our voices be known to these legislators that are almost, in my mind, just because I didn't know about it, secretly making these deals?
Yeah, that's a great point. So we would encourage people to first get involved in their backyard. So obviously, you know, the Western states, trail volunteering is a perfect example. As a next phase of Run Wild, we're actually hoping to encourage a big push for regular volunteering by trail runners. And I have to say, I'm guilty myself. I think a lot of us have full-time jobs. The weekend is a time to do our long runs. There have been so many instances where I've passed a group of volunteers on a Saturday and they're out running the trail, maintaining the trails that I run on. And so I'd like to hold myself accountable to this. And in fact, we're gathering a group tomorrow here in Marin to do our first volunteer event. And so, yes, essentially, you know, we think that to really be engaged in this issue, you have to love the lands that give you a connection to kind of the bigger movement and idea. And so that starts in your own backyard. And I think as we've been discussing this issue, I realize that it can sound like somewhat of a vague, far off thing, like we're talking about lands in Utah and, well, you know, if you don't live in Utah, what does that really mean? And I think that you have to just have that direct connection. And that's why this issue has resonated so much with trail runners, because you can't really love a place unless you're, you know, directly interacting and sort of connecting with it. And so that takes place every day with the training miles that we put out on the trails, you know, through the adventure runs that we do with friends and the memories that we make there. And so we are really encouraging people to engage in their backyards. And that might mean, you know, contacting the local nonprofit that helps organize trail volunteer events and signing up your running club. You know, it might just be a few friends, but we think over time that that could be a really positive force, and that's something that we'd like the trail community to consider moving in that direction. And then secondly, what Run Wild is hoping to do is to become a conduit for sort of the higher level political events happening. And so by working with the Wilderness Society, we're hoping to stay in touch with them to essentially hear, you know, what is the most relevant event this week? Because, you know, the funny thing is, as we were forming and we're thinking about a mission and kind of what are long-term goals, we reached out to the Wilderness Society and they said, you know, guys, we are working on this issue day in and day out, and it changes day in and day out. So something can come up in 2 weeks from now, and we really can't anticipate that. So let's just stay nimble. And so that's why Run Wild is taking a pretty flexible approach. You know, we have our Instagram feed, and that's where we've been most engaged with users in terms of trying to offer, you know, which political event is kind of most relevant in terms of week by week, and to just basically receive that information from the Wilderness Society and then share it with the community. And so, again, we're pretty young and just heading on to about a month now. And so we're hoping to build those connections a little stronger, but we would essentially become kind of the conduit so that if runners are looking to get engaged at a higher level in places like Utah, where right now Bear Series is a place where runners can really speak up, and you don't have to be a runner, you can be a hiker, any, you know, really any American citizen. And I think as we've seen, especially this year, it's people power that has the difference. And we are just trying to basically mobilize the community so that as these events do come into play, we're already in sort of a collective unit and we can share a unified voice rather than having to kind of get, you know, gather the troops at the last minute and have sort of disparate representation. We're really trying to get people together around this idea and to have it come from a place of joy, because our sport is really, you know, it thrives on the love of the land where we run and also the relationships that happen through those miles that we share. So we're really trying to come from a point of celebration.
We focused all of this podcast on the public lands here in the United States, and there are other countries throughout the world that have public lands. The Commonwealth countries such as Australia, New Zealand, Canada, they have public lands called crown lands, which I like that term. Yeah. And I guess they've had some similar situations where there have been proposals to sell these crown lands to private industry. You know, Portugal, France, they all have these public lands and similar issues. So if you don't live in the United States and you've been listening to this and you're kind of snoozing off for a little bit, you know, you may have the same issue. You know, greed does not reside just in the U.S. Get involved in your country and what public lands you have available and how you can support your local government.
And it's not only the training miles that we're logging, but future generations. And that, you know, yeah. we don't want to take trail running away from you know, the people that are following us.
And I love the mortgage payment I have for the 640 million acres that I own.
Which is what?
Very little. Well, every once in a while I pay like a $10 parking pass, and that's or a fee to get into the, which is pretty inexpensive.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Emily, thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. We will link more links in the podcast description so people can get involved. I absolutely want to link that Patagonia video. So if somebody doesn't know how to use Google and Google Patagonia video bear's ears, you can just go to the podcast description and click on the link.
And it looks like you have a website, runwild.live. Is that your website?
Yep, that's correct. And then we're most active on Instagram, and the handle again is just runwild. And I would also note that we're doing a fundraiser for the Wilderness Society. And so proceeds from a really great t-shirt designed by Maggie Tides is also linked through Instagram and the website as well.
Nice. We'll link that too. Do you have some manufacturers that are like Patagonia, some real strong mm-hmm. voices that are getting behind your movement?
Yeah, it's a great question. We've received outreach from a handful of companies, and I think that's our next phase, is considering what that partnership will look like. And it's something we're really excited about and kind of sorting through strategically how we can work that out.
I like the power of the people thing. It would be fantastic if we could get with Mark Gillian of Ultra Runner Sign Up, something like that, to have a checkbox at the end to say, yeah, for this race, I'm going to donate, you know, $5, $10, whatever you want, some fee to move towards your movement, because after all, mm-hmm. we're running on those public lands, and that would be a nice way to maybe rally awareness too. I'm just thinking out.
No, that's a great point. Actually, we were quite pleasantly surprised that the women's winner of Chuckanut this year donated a portion of her prize purse to the Wilderness Society and to the Washington State Parks Foundation. And that was, you know, independent. She mentioned Run Wild, but that was independently of us, and I think a great model.
I'm gonna commit right now. My next winnings, 100% of my next winnings will go straight to your organization. I'll even match it with my own funds.
We would be honored.
Hey, Emily, tell us a little bit about, here in the United States, we have an annual day called Run Wild. It's called Earth Day,
uh-huh.
and Earth Day is on a special day that's close to my heart, which is April 22nd. But tell us, you have something that you've worked on with Trail Runner Magazine on April 22nd. What is that? Tell us about how we can get involved with that.
Yeah, so that's a national event called our Run-In Day, and that's a tangible day for runners all around the country to get involved in this initiative. So we're essentially encouraging runners to rally their friends, get a group of friends, and run on public lands that day. Usually you're out there, you know, snapping a picture. So in addition to that, we would like you to actually share something about those lands, basically how they were protected, when they were protected, and what those lands mean to you. And Trail Runner Magazine is actually sponsoring a mini contest. And so they'll take all the photos and aggregate them and then pick a handful of winners, which we're really excited about. And so that's our first kind of national event for anyone to get involved in, regardless of where you live. And we're excited to see all the submissions roll in. And it obviously coincides with Earth Day. And so as I understand, the first Earth Day observed in the U.S. was actually an environmental teach-in. And it was basically looking at things like pollution and things that, you know, we now have the EPA and regulations for, to minimize the harm of. And so our idea is to do a kind of teach-in of public lands, and so to educate ourselves about the lands that we run on and appreciate day to day.
And it's on a Saturday, so you don't even have to take off work.
Perfect.
Exactly. Get your Saturday social run.
Maybe a slightly abstract comment, but that's pretty usual around here. I've often thought about that, the public lands, state lands, and then some privately held lands, that there are some pretty cool people that allow us to run through their own private property to connect some of these public lands. And I've often thought how nice it is that they're generous with the use of that land. And I don't know where the markers are for private, public. I don't know. But I know that I cross them at times. And I'm just appreciative of that generosity of that silent group that hold the lease and the ownership of those lands. So another good reason to take care of the ground that we run on is it's not all belonging to us. We are guests in some cases as we're going across others' property.
You know, I'm gonna throw in another plug.
Yeah.
You just reminded me.
Yes.
You know, one of the great stewards of our public lands are the farmers and the ranchers, mm-hmm. and that's close to my heart because mm-hmm. that's in my profession. They lease public lands for grazing their cattle and their sheep, and in many cases, most cases, they are good protectors of that land. They use their own money to help sustain those lands that they're taking their cattle and sheep on. So I want to throw out a hoot.
They're at risk too.
They are.
Yeah.
Yep. So thank you very much, Emily. We appreciate you bringing this to our attention. Boy, I'll tell you, it's really raised and opened my eyes. So I'm going to pay a little more attention. I mean, I knew a little bit of what happened with what happened in Utah with the outdoor retailer show, but I kind of went, I don't live there. It doesn't really. Guess what? It matters, and we need to get involved. We need to find out more information, and then get active, get excited about mm-hmm. it, and make your voice known.
Emily, what's your next run? What's next for you as a runner, on the public lands?
That's a great question. I have my sights set on Sierra Mountain Adventure, so I'm currently kind of going through trail maps, thinking of actually a backpacking trip, or maybe fast packing. I do love the races, but I also really just value kind of the open time and unstructured time of spending a few days out in the wilderness. So that's currently what has me most excited.
Hey, well, good for you. And glad we were able to get on it on the early part of this, of your Run Wild at 3 weeks old. We're happy to join in early.
And thank everybody that you're working with at Run Wild for bringing this to our attention.
Now go out and run.
Thank you so much. Yeah,
wild.
Keep it wild.
There we go. Keep it wild.
Keep it wild, Moss.
Yeah. So keep it wild.
Moss.
Perfect.